Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Alina, predictably, is bouncing off the walls today because one of her favourite people has come to join us. Alina, who's here?
So we have with us Tim Reynolds, who's a senior lecturer in archaeology at Birkbeck University of London. And of course, he is a former lecturer of mine. He taught me all I need to know and exactly how to be an archaeologist. So sorry if I mess up, it's all Tim's fault. He's got way too many publications to list, so we're going to skip that. And he specialises in Neanderthals and the modern human, which is exactly what we're going to be talking about today. It's exciting.
Hi Tim.
Hello, hi there.
Right, okay. Alina, you know Tim well. What's this about a Mary Beard exam question?
So I did my first course was with Tim, and he taught us methods and practice in archaeology. And it's not easy. I'm just warning you guys, it's not easy. And the night before the exam, I went and watched Mary Beard's Pompeii thing on TV. And I managed to answer like half the questions in the exam, sorry, Tim, on this one episode. And I actually got a really good mark. So I'm quite excited. Sorry, Tim, now you know my dirty little secret.
It just proves that Mary's awesome.
She is indeed, yeah. But make us all redundant, but be careful.
That's so true. She works very, very hard. So Matt Pope came on a couple of weeks ago and talked all about Neanderthals. And now you're here to talk to us about modern humans from the prehistoric era. Can you just briefly tell our listeners why they're different things?
Right, well, they're completely different species
Okay.
currently as we define things, although that may change. In the old days when we were growing up, if two individuals could interbreed and produce viable offspring, they were the same species. Fossil species, that's different, particularly when they're closely related. So Neanderthals are a different species at the moment, but it seems that because we picked up Neanderthal genes, we can actually interbreed with them. So we need to be thinking. I mean, there is a debate going on about what now constitutes a species.
So
So,
is this like when we talk about early humans, just so our listeners understand, it's like when you're looking at apes and you can say, well, they're all apes, but that's a chimpanzee and that's a different ape. And so it's kind of like that, isn't it? So they're all humans, but they're all distinct species from each other.
yeah, that's the thing. When you're looking at species that are so closely linked, then you always get these issues. Where do you actually end up drawing the line? Some with all the work on DNA now, some people have even argued that in fact we're so little different, we should actually include chimps as part of our own lineage, that we are, if you like, just a variation on a chimp theme, which I don't agree with, I have to
Like to say, I'm a bit like a monkey sometimes. I don't know about you, Alex.
say. You're like a monkey all the time.
I jump off the walls, like you said earlier. That is what I do.
Whatever. Monkeys are cool. I love them. I went and hung out with gorillas in December in Rwanda and Uganda, and they were epic.
Kind of sounds exciting. I've got to go and do that.
It was brilliant. It just like even they're so like us, it was just brutal. It was just like the little hands are exactly
There
the
you go,
same as
Tim.
ours.
Tim, your whole research has just been debunked by Alex because she said that they're just like us. Sorry. Alex, stop with these gorillas. Let's go back to modern humans, right? So, Tim, when did the first modern humans appear on the map?
Right. Well, recently we've discovered that we are almost twice as old as we thought. The oldest now we have for modern humans is about 330,000 years ago, a site called Jebel Irhoud up in Morocco in North Africa.
Do you know, I was reading about that and I can't believe that we can pinpoint something so unique.
Well, that's because they've actually got the fossils from that particular cave. I mean, so given that they're there 330,000 years ago, there should be like a tail going further back, 360, maybe even 400, to when the species actually comes into being. So what we have is we have dated sites and particular places, but the picture is always going to be much more fuzzy than that. We're dealing with sort of evolutionary and geological time. It's so when I say 330,000 years ago, Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock, it's not that sort of detail. We don't have that kind of detail. But what that did do is add, basically, we thought before that we only dated back 180,000 years, so a huge lump of time. And it begs the question, well, where are the other guys? Where are the rest of the modern humans between 180,000 and 330,000? We just haven't found them yet.
For that reason, there's massive debate, isn't there, about where early modern humans come from. And what kind of evidence is there?
Well, there's three different sorts of evidence. The best evidence at the moment is basically the fossil record itself. And when you get back as far as 330,000, they're like us, but they're still different. They're enough like us to be classified with us, and they're different enough from other things to be not with us. But that's what we've got. The skulls are as close as much as we can get to being us. The other evidence is DNA, but DNA doesn't preserve very well. In the key place we really need to be chewing into the DNA evidence, of course, is in Africa. And, so we need more DNA from Africa to identify what fossils should be placed where. And then the third source of evidence is probably the worst sort of evidence, really, which is the archaeology. I hate to say this as an archaeologist, but archaeologists tend to think that different species make different tools. And therefore, if you find one sort of tool, that must mean, that's the species you get with it. So hand axes, we used to think, were Homo erectus. Whereas in fact, now we know that modern humans, Neanderthals, all sorts of creatures made hand axes. So the archaeology is the weakest evidence. The DNA is the hardest to pin down. So fossils are our main evidence.
Was there average lifespan like us? I mean, what do we live to? Most of us were 80, 90 years old, if I'm not mistaken. Someone's going to correct me that I'm completely wrong. But
it's going to be less than that, isn't that? That far back without medicine and
It's hard
care.
To say, because for individuals to end up in the fossil record, they are by the nature of the evidence, they're unusual, because most bodies just rot away and never get fossilized. Given what we have, though, I mean, 40 plus is certainly a lot of fossils and things we have seem to be getting on to that sort of age. 40 years. That would be old. 40,000.
Yeah.
40 plus.
That's getting into Mary Berry territory there.
I'm sure she'd saying that.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, so, but the biggest risk, a lot of child mortality, a lot of infant mortality, women dying in childbirth, and lots of accidents. And of course, infectious disease, before antibiotics, even modern humans died very rapidly of all sorts of things we take for granted now is not important. But if you've made it to sort of 40, the odds are making it to 50 was quite possible, and maybe 60 and beyond as well. So on average, we can say, the lifespan sort of 40 to 50, 40 to 60, but it depends on your individual life history as to where you fall out of that, in terms of when you actually die.
You talked about them making things like axes and stuff. What can you tell about their behaviour from the evidence you have? Is it comparable to ours?
If we're talking about modern humans, they are essentially us, but earlier versions of it. What you see is the thing that makes us special is the fact that we aren't easily categorized and put in a box. We do lots of different things. We're incredibly flexible and very versatile with what we do. So when you look at the sort of tombstone technologies of the period when we are just emerging, what you see in the stone technologies is a standardized way of making things that then can be applied to any situation. So they're organizing themselves so that the stone tools can be used. If you want to butcher an animal, you've got sharp knives, you can get on and do that. But equally, you can use the same sorts of technology to process plants. And you can also apply hunting technology to different sized game and so on. So it's flexibility that's the key to it. But points and scrapers and blades and so on, they all are being made. It used to be, so I'm sorry if I'm talking too fast, but tell me to slow down if I'm too fast.
No, it's great. We're both really excited.
Okay, well, that's good. It used to be thought modern humans were all about making blades, but blades come in different places at different times, are used by different species.
See, so Time Team has done that to people, hasn't it? Because every time they do prehistory, they're looking for a pointy bit of rock.
Harsh, but probably true. Yeah. the thing is, we as archaeologists, we need to be able to sort of categorize materials. We need a language, the basic language, to define our tools and things so we can know what we're talking about. But the danger is then the meaning we put on top of that. So, hand axes, Homo erectus, scrapers, Neanderthals, blades, modern humans. It worked for a while, but now we can look, worldwide at sort of the nature of variability, and it doesn't work anymore. There's a trend towards much more blade use and so on with modern humans. microlithic use and so on too. But you know, it's never simple. You always need to look at the context in which the evidence is being brought up.
My next question is going to be, so I love this. So I'm really fascinated, and Linda as well, I know Linda, you're listening, with religion and burial methods. I mean, do we know if they've practiced anything of the sort?
Wow, right. That's very timely, because the team I work with just published a paper this couple of months ago now on prehistoric burial, particularly looking at Neanderthals.
Oh, wow.
And I don't want to spend too much time on Neanderthals because I know you've already covered them, but we've been working at the site of Shanidar in Iraq, and we've discovered another, well, it may be another Neanderthal, it may be one that was already partly found before. And at that site, they claim they were buried with flowers. You know, Neanderthals came along and they buried a series of individuals in exactly the same spot, within 2 meters, you know, exactly the same spot, in a cave that's, you know, 1,000 square meters in area. They come to exactly the same spot and burying individuals at different times. So there's obviously something means a lot to them to be coming there and burying their interring, burying, you know. Sometimes we need to be careful about the language we use, that, you know, the bodies are being disposed of in the ground, as it were. You know, it just scoops out and then they're being buried, you know, earth being thrown over the top. There's an argument about whether they were buried with flowers based on the pollen, and the jury on that one is still out. Although I tend to believe that, in fact, first of all, when I went to work at the site, I thought, no, yeah, it can't be true, you know, flower burials and so on. Increasingly, the evidence to me looks like perhaps they actually were burying Neanderthals with flowers. So again, what does that mean? We don't know. But we have relatively a lot of Neanderthal fossils compared to their contemporary modern humans. So when we think about, did modern humans bury their dead? We certainly do. And if we trace that further and further back, you think about the Neolithic, you get ritual monuments where some people are being buried. And that's the other thing, of course, it's not everybody who's being buried, it's just some people. So, you know, what's the significance of that? Are you looking at, you know, key individuals, important figures? Are you looking at hierarchy? All these sorts of things could be considered. But Neanderthals seem to be burying their dead in a way that's more visible in the archaeological record than modern humans are at the same time. So there's lots of questions that link to that. You know, what does that mean about religious beliefs, their intelligence, their do they have belief in afterlife? Are they just getting rid of something that's going to get very smelly and attract a lot of predators? You know?
Yeah, it's true.
All of these things are something that, you know, we need to take into account. But it does look like Neanderthals are doing things that, if it was us, we would say were pretty clever.
That's brilliant. I love the nuances of it. It's great. Talk about eating. So we talked to Matt about what Neanderthals were eating, and that is it the same, or what evidence have you got about I mean, Alina's put, how did they eat? I'm like, well, they put it in their mouth, Alina, but I'm sure she meant something else by that question when she wrote it. But yeah, so what do we know about them eating?
Right, well, again, one of the old cliches used to be that modern humans were smarter and cleverer and could eat a wide range of species that Neanderthals were not able to collect, but equally that modern humans could also be very specialist and focus down on particular species and hit them particularly hard when they're in season, so salmon runs or reindeer when they're migrating and so on. Now, again, it's difficult. The record is always biased against plant eating because, of course, you know, the plants don't preserve very well, but they seem to be eating the same ranges of species, but modern humans hit coastal resources, you know, shellfish, sooner than before Neanderthals seem to be doing it. The evidence for Neanderthals is a bit equivocal. Fish, birds, rabbits, you know, small furry floppy things. You know, they're eating a whole range of things. Tortoises. You know, they're snack in a pack. You know, you basically just turn one upside down, it can't go away, you can come back and stick it on the fire whenever you feel like it. So, you know, there were...
I can't get over that image in my mind.
I'm sorry about that. So they can eat, you know, a whole range of different, you know, animal species, and the technologies for that, they seem to be using things like traps. At one site I worked at in Borneo, they seem to be eating things like catfish, which live in the bottom of muddy streams, but they don't seem to have sort of the nets and things to catch them. How are they getting them? This is the big question. Well, we found these big, big pits with starch grains in them from plants which are poisonous, new taro, things like these ground storage root vegetables, which you have to soak and dry, pound, and then they make flour and then you could eat them. But that produces a lot of toxins in water. So if you took that water and then throw it into the river, basically the catfish are poisoned, they could just float up to the surface, and you've got fish from that means as well. So we think they may actually be doing that 40,000 years ago in Borneo.
That's really smart.
It's incredibly smart. I mean, it's one of those things I always you ponder. Who was the first person who discovered that you can eat this thing, but only if you pound it and soak it and pound it and soak it? I mean,
Someone who didn't like their mother-in-law and was desperate.
How poor could you have been, Yeah.
Yeah. Can I ask a really tangential question and just go off on one?
No.
No, I want to. Cannibalism. So obviously, to us now, it's unacceptable to eat your own species. But what about back then? Is there any evidence of it? I don't know why this interests me, but it does. I mean, is it because it's just a survival thing, isn't it? If the
meat
is
there. Do you want
to
eat me? Is this what it is? You're planning on eating me or something?
Possibly. I'm just trying to think how I'd cook you now, but that's really going off on a tangent. No, but I'm just interested, back then, do you see evidence of like a practicality in that perhaps there was meat available if someone died and they were fresh, so they ate it? I'm interested.
Well, the evidence from a couple of sites suggests that Neanderthals might have done. The evidence for modern humans is more equivocal at the same sort of stage. Uh-huh. The times in which they're living could have been actually, with harsh ice ages, long, hot winters and so on, the amount of protein might not be very much. So the idea of granny's looking a bit past it anyway, she can spare a limb, might actually...
But I'm just thinking of that.
If somebody died, you can just then reprocess them.
But yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It's just like a practical sort of solution. Granny could feed you for a few days. I don't know.
Oh my God, Alex, I'm sitting here laughing.
I just want to know if it's something, the idea that we don't eat each other is something that's evolved over a long, long time, is what I'm asking. I don't know why I've suddenly become really interested in this, whether it's a very modern concept or whether we can see evidence of it not being acceptable that long ago.
It's one of those things that, the argument is always out on. If you want to sort of diss the neighbours, you always say, oh, they're cannibals. So a lot of the historical accounts of cannibalism, when you investigate them, are actually basically people just dissing their next door neighbours.
Oh, we've had that on History Hack before. The first thing people accuse each other of is eating babies in long periods of history.
That's right. Yeah, indeed. When there were problems with in sort of the early postmodern period with sort of Ireland and England and battles, the Irish were dismissed as, oh yeah, they eat, they're cannibals, and it's trying to create something that is different and other and nasty and horrible. So it's just one of those things you throw at people. But at the same time, cannibalism, if it's a way of processing war dead or capturing the powers of individuals or just humiliating individuals, is something that modern humans have practiced. How far back that goes, we just don't know.
Thank you for indulging that.
You're welcome.
It just suddenly occurred to me, and I was really interested.
If you want to look outside our species, chimpanzees have been known to do it too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they actually hunt and kill usually younger males of other chimpanzee packs.
That's like two birds with one stone, isn't it? Taking out like potentially future dominant males in opposing groups and getting dinner at the same time.
Oh my god.
No, it's interesting. So gorillas is like, it's my numbers, I haven't, this was 6 months ago, but gorillas are like 98% the same, but what are we like 95% the same as chimpanzees?
Gorillas are less close than the chimpanzees are.
Oh, so it's the other way around.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. Okay. But to be honest, we can get a bit over enthusiastic with the biochemistry, as it were. So there are people who say that we are actually so close to the chimps that we should be called chimps. Well, I think those are guys who just don't get out enough, too much time in the lab.
That's like, I need to write an article for a journal and I need to say something epic. I'm going to go with this. Is that right? Have I just made an enemy of all the chimp-loving archaeologists?
Anthropologists.
That's the ones.
No.
Right, okay, let's get back onto Alina's questions because they are really good and I've just waffled on about something really nonsense now. Alina would like to know about living space. Is there archaeological evidence for where they live? Are they nomadic? Do they move around? Or do we see homes?
Home is where the heart is, and we don't know what they thought. There are sites where people are clearly living longish periods. It's been argued that Neanderthals tended to move as a group en masse around the landscape and exploit animals as they go and plants as they go, whereas modern humans tended to be more organized. They would place groups in areas where resources are good and local, and then send out work parties to actually do a bit of hunting, bring stuff back and provision. The idea of it's like a home base, you know, where everyone can be, and you send out work parties and so on. So modern humans' sites tend to be more of them. They tend to be larger, more diverse in terms of their contents and what they construct. There seem to be some evidence for structures, but you know, not substantial housing, but you know, tents and so on. And different organization of the tasks in different places. So there'd be napping areas, hearth areas, sleeping areas, and so on. But you know, they define their space by what they do around them. I mean, one of the guys in the group we were talking about burials suggests that Neanderthals basically worked around them. So basically their living space was what was around them within reach and so on. Whereas modern humans tend to cooperate more, sit around and work together more. So it's like a social space, the sense of social space was different between Neanderthals and modern humans as well. So it's a complex thing because modern humans, what are we talking about? Are we talking about these guys 330,000 years ago where we have virtually no evidence? Or are we talking about them 40,000, 30,000 years ago where we have increasing amounts of evidence? But they do seem to be much more organized technologically and things. They're moving materials across the landscape more. So they're moving a lot of raw materials, exotic raw materials, and things like this around the landscape more too. So they're logistically organized, they're out and about, but it's work parties. So different groups of people who then come back to the main group seem to be the way they seem to be organized.
Can I throw something in here?
Yep.
I'm gonna
sounds throw... worried now. He's like, is it going to be weirder than the cannibal stuff?
No. I don't want to start a whole debate about it because I think it's a whole podcast in itself. Completely a podcast in itself, but Tim took us around some old stuff when we were at uni.
The technical term.
I can't remember exactly where we went. We went to a place that had sticks in the ground and some sort of... No, don't laugh at me.
We've done this before and we usually come to the conclusion that you were at Woodhenge.
That's the one! Woodhenge, thank you. Thank you. I forgot what it was called. But I wanted to throw in here a bit of Stonehenge because you just triggered my mind and saying, oh, they moved materials around. There we go, Stonehenge. If you want to hit us with one line, maybe two lines about it, because we'd love to come and do another podcast about Stonehenge in itself.
Well, Stonehenge is obviously much, 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 much later and different economy and so on. But interesting about Stonehenge is it's been suggested that not only did they move the stones, the blue stones from Wales, but they actually all moved them in order of that reflected the geology of the mountains they came from, the Priscilla Hills. So they're different types of bluestone, and they were actually transferred and ordered according to the geology of where they came from. So not only are they moving things vast distances, but they know their stones. They know which stone is which and what order they should all be going in. And then they recycle them. So there's blue Stonehenge that's over down towards the river, which then gets recycled as they rework and rebuild one of the phases of Stonehenge, the later stages in Stonehenge.
Okay, so in my mind, again, you're all going to laugh at me. In my mind, I've got this image of early humans either running around completely naked or with some sort of loincloth wrapped around their
bits.
Parts. do we know if they actually wore any clothing at all? And is there any evidence of it?
Good question. There's evidence for weaving and and some textiles that dates back sort of towards about 30,000 years ago. So the odds are they were, you know, they were certainly making using string and woven things. It's a short step from making woven things like, you know, nets and things to catch animals to tying things up to yourself and wrapping them around you. The odds are they also were wearing skins and hides and so on. So I think it's they're almost certain. I don't know if, you know, if you fancy going sort of standing completely naked in the middle of winter in Britain. You know, these guys are living through ice ages where conditions were much, much harsher. It's not impossible. I mean, when they discovered the Tierra del Fuegans in the bottom of South America, they had horrendous cold, wet, damp conditions, and people were running around virtually naked there. So we have a great ability to adjust to conditions, but allowing for that, I suspect that actually they were wearing clothes. And in fact, we have a very bizarre line of evidence in terms of the DNA of body lice and hair lice, because you can see how they've evolved. And they've evolved hand in hand with our bodies and the fact that we cover them up so that they're protected and they can, you know, so they can speciate and things on the new conditions of people wearing clothes. It's a nice thought to end on. How are your lice? Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Arts. Do they practice music? Maybe harder to discover than things like cave art, or are they amusing themselves as well as just trying to survive and not freeze to death?
Very much so. I mean, I think they actually had quite a rich social life. I mean, what else do you do in those dark rooms?
Better than us now, anyway.
Well, imagine what, you know, we're sort of partitioned and under lockdown in very small groups. They were pretty, but we have, you know, media to get out through. They would be in large groups in confined spaces for long periods of time over winter and so on. What do you do to amuse the kids? What do you do to sort of keep people happy and engaged and so on? You sing, you perform. And if you look at modern humans, they have large hearts, people, their centers, their focal points, you know, for performance and so on. So you can well imagine people sort of singing around the campfire. You can imagine it, but how do you find physical evidence for it? And archaeologically, of course, you know, we have large campfires, but that's all we have. We don't have, you know, any of those things. There are some things that have been claimed to be musical instruments, you know, bird bones with piercings through them, so they could use them as flutes and so on. But again, a lot of musical instruments are made from organic, you know, composition materials, and so they waste away. But I would say it was almost certain that they were using musical instruments and things. And art, well, you know, art in various forms, however you interpret the record, could go back over 200,000 years in Southeast Asia. Neanderthals, it now seems, were making art 67,000 years ago in Spain, painting caves and doing a sort of noughts and crosses board engraved in the cave at in Gibraltar. So Neanderthals were doing it. It may be we actually learned it from them, but we certainly were doing it too. But again, not everywhere. Not every society is doing all these things all at the same time. It's very easy to become sort of stereotype. All modern humans were like this. But, you know, people are variable, people are different, and cultures are emerging through these times and isolating and, you know, defining themselves differently.
Tim, you have done some just amazing excavations. We all know this from being in your lectures. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, do go to Birkbeck if you want to study archaeology. Tim is a fantastic lecturer. And you've gone literally around the world doing your excavations. Can you tell us what is the most interesting thing you have ever found on an excavation?
Ah, well, this is if you like, this is my life cycle. When I was a teenager, that's a long time ago, back in the 70s, there was a Scientific American came out about the Shanidar Neanderthals. You know, and that's one of the things that got me into archaeology in the first place. And now, amazingly, I am actually digging the Shanidar Neanderthals, wouldn't you, with a great team. And so to excavate, the last 2-3 years, we've had the skull, mandible, shoulders, hat, one hand, ribs and back of a Neanderthal is just the most awesome thing. It just really brings these people together. And it's been a lifelong interest. So for me, digging Shanidar is just like the best. It doesn't get much better.
Dreams come true, right? Eventually.
Yeah. I mean, I've never dreamt of that sort of, you know, gawky teenage kid, you could see me, and you think, bloody hell, how's that? So, pardon. You know.
What's the best thing that's come out of it so far?
Well, having the physical remains of a Neanderthal. They are still incredibly rare. So to have, I mean, and also to have the iconic bit, you know, the skull and the jaw, the teeth, you know, the head of a human being is always a significant thing, you know, think of a head cult and all the rest of it. So to have a Neanderthal skull there in the ground and seeing it painstakingly excavated and removed, and we had a brilliant you know, human bones person who lifted it. It took forever to do, to, you know, conserve it and treat it so you could lift it. She did an amazing job. And, you know, to have that there, I mean, it's just fantastic.
I could have seen the look on your face in my mind right now, you know, finding it and then going, oh my God, it's coming out of the ground. This is so exciting. Sorry.
Well, it is. I mean, well, that's, you know, I wouldn't say we're all treasure hunters at heart, but we all, you know, that joy, the excitement of discovering something and being the first person or one of the first people to engage with that after all these thousands of years. I mean, it is. That's the romance of archaeology still. It's still a fantastic thing to be doing. Real privilege.
That's why Alex and I have to go and do some more, because I haven't done any digging, gosh, in about 3 years now. So don't hold that against me. But I'm trying to convince Alex for us to go and do some really cool stuff. And we're trying to jump on, you know, and look at what people are digging and do our own little time team, right, Alex?
Boom. Pointy rocks all round. It's just my brother's one pet peeve of being made to sit through this on a Sunday evening back in the day was that he'd have to sit through it for an hour and they'd find nothing but a bit of flint and tell you that it had been worked into a pointy object of some description by someone a very long time ago and that he felt cheated at having spent an hour on it. But this is more about my brother than it does about archaeologists. Let's finish with, so we talked about what you have found. Mm. Is there something you would like to find that would answer a burning question that you have? What would be your dream find?
It probably doesn't exist, but a mixed cemetery with Neanderthal and modern human bodies buried together with organic preservation. I mean, it's the ultimate fantasy. And it, you know,
and grave goods and stuff.
Yeah, the whole shebang. Answers everything all in one. You know, we can all retire then. You know.
Is this something that's contentious, how much they intermingled with each other?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they did interbreed, but on what terms? And, you know, all those sorts of issues and how frequently and where and so on. Yeah, and you know, reconstructions, the recent, relatively recent reconstructions of Neanderthal, the Natural History Museum, for example, had them with tattoos.
You know, oh, wow.
But did they? So just answering those sorts of questions, what did they look like? We know that, you know, some of them had red hair. You know, so just bring up the humanity of it. What we have are dry stones and bones. And it's our job to sort of put flesh on them. But it'd make our lives an awful lot easier if they came with flesh attached and we could actually say, wow, okay, yeah, we're actually right. Or we're not right, you know? So yeah, that would be fantastic to have everything you ever wanted sat there on one site. Hugely expensive, and how do you preserve all the dead bodies and stuff? But wow, what a sort of thing to have.
Who cares? We'll crowdfund it. You find it, we'll crowdfund it.
Exactly. Come to us and we'll get it all sorted for you. Not a problem.
I remember that.
I'm pretty sure everyone would work for free on that site if you found it anyway.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God. Do you know what? I'm thinking about how you said about this cemetery, you know, inverted commas. But how are people going to view us in hundreds and thousands of years now, the way we live? You know, oh, look, I just found this sort of thing with buttons on it, you know, telephone, or, you know, what did we look like? It's just really interesting looking back so far to think, what are people going to look at us like in the future?
Yeah, in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there was that joke about, you know, the shoe layer, where all these people had shoes are built up. Who knows, to be honest? I suspect, you know, hundreds of thousands of years from now, it's debatable whether or not we will be here. You know, we face many, many challenges at the moment. I think we're ingenious. I think a variation on the theme of us will be here. But whether they will do archaeology and whether they'll be interested in the past, they may actually look back at the past and think, thanks, guys. You really, once you got us into this mess, look at the, you know, look at the plastic layer, look at the, you know, the lack of biodiversity, look at the mess you made. So it's always good to have someone to blame. So, you know, who knows what people many, many years hence would say about us. But archaeologically, we've certainly left a huge, huge imprint on the planet.
They'll find you, Tim, with your trowel and your paintbrush.
Surrounded in plastic, yeah.
Tim, that was so awesome to have you back on and have you chatting to us about the modern human, talking to us about just the incredible amount of evidence, because I didn't realise how much actual evidence there really was. I'm really sorry for being so ignorant, but it is just great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was fun.
Join us tomorrow when Nick Ramos returns to talk all about Cuban history. He covered it for us before and he went up to the 20th century. Now we're getting into the good stuff. We're getting into Castro. We're getting into the revolution. So don't miss that, because once again, he's on fire.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.